I broadcasting loud enough in the back? You'll tell me if it gets too soft. Okay. Well, I want to thank you for inviting me. And in particular, I want to thank Professor Stanley for extending this invitation. This is a somewhat special invitation for me, based on the kinds of work that I've been involved in over the last 20 years. I'm going to talk today about the two giant heat engines that operate inside the Earth's interior. And if I trace back some of the roots of the ideas that I'm going to discuss, those roots lead to this department. So in the late 1940s and 1950s, a member of this department, a very distinguished member, Teddy Bullard, was one of the founding fathers of the modern dynamo theory for the origin of magnetic fields in planets and stars. And then, of course, perhaps more of you know that Tuzo Wilson, a longtime illustrious member of this department, was instrumental in the foundations of plate tectonics. So both of these bear on the subjects I'm going to discuss. I should also mention that I've been associated with Dick Peltier for a large number of years. I guess he's off on travel. And I'm also very heartened to see that the torches have been passed to a new generation of individuals. And so the tradition of this kind of work is continuing in good hands in this department. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is the geodynamo from a whole Earth perspective. So we're going to first talk about what I mean by the geodynamo and then talk about what I mean by a whole Earth perspective. So here are the topics, just a short tour on the geodynamo. This is going to review the kind of stuff that Professor Stanley does, so I'll pass through this rather quickly. Perhaps a lot of you are already familiar with a lot of the details even, but just to set the stage. And then I want to focus on what is one of the defining characteristics of the geomagnetic field, which is its propensity to reverse its polarity on occasion. What I'm going to focus on here is not when reversals have occurred in the past, but what they mean for the past. And then, because there's lots of young people here and people who are also young at heart, okay, I'll try to identify what I think are some of the frontier areas in this subject area. Okay, so these are cross-sections showing the interior structure of planets in the solar system. Okay, and virtually all the objects in this image here do now have, or at once in their past, had magnetic fields of their own. And although there are substantial differences in the way these magnetic fields are generated from instance to instance, they all have the same underlying commonality. So really, there are only three major ingredients you need to make a planetary dynamo. You need electrically conducting fluid somewhere in the planetary interior. You need an energy source to stir that fluid, so a source of kinetic energy. That's often convection, but it could be other sources of fluid motions. And then you need planetary rotation, and that's basically to produce some of the required magnetic feedbacks. So in different ways, all of these planets satisfy those three requirements, and that's why planetary magnetism is nearly universal in the solar system. The only large object in the solar system that may not have had a self-sustaining dynamo, we don't really know, is our sister planet Venus. But for example, what Professor Stanley's group has demonstrated is that these conditions are met even in very small objects in the solar system, like planetesimals. There's evidence now that planetesimals at the early stages of development of the solar system, very small objects, perhaps some as small as the area the size of the city of Toronto, had this phenomena occurring in their interiors as well. So by the way, I've been involved with dynamos for about the last 20 years, and the 20 years before that, I was primarily involved with questions regarding mantle convection and plate tectonics. And if you open up a standard elementary textbook in the geosciences, you'll see something that says something like, plate tectonics is easy to understand because it's based on simple kinematic rules that anybody can grasp, and dynamos are mysterious objects that nobody really understands. Okay? Well, the commonality of dynamos in the solar system and the fact that we have only one known example of plate tectonics anywhere in the universe tends to belie that fact. And so while the details of how you generate a magnetic field may be complex, the overall number of ingredients are not. And so that accounts for the difference. So What is the geodynamo? So we'll talk about it in terms of a process, start with the energetics, and then talk about a few of the relevant timescales. So this is a cross-section of the Earth's interior, showing the mantle, which is silicates and oxides. And we're going to be focusing on the iron-rich core, inner and outer core. The outer core is liquid, and the inner core is solid. CMB represents the core mantle boundary. ICB represents the inner core boundary, the boundary between the solid and liquid portions. So the energetics, here's how we currently understand it. Now, this is deep Earth geophysics, so these numbers are subject to change almost on a daily basis. But heat loss to the mantle, the core is hotter than the mantle. We now estimate that heat loss to be between 10 and 16 terawatts, plus chemical differentiation associated with the solidification of the inner core produces thermochemical convection in the liquid outer core. So that's the mechanism by which kinetic energy is generated in the outer core. And then the dynamics are the convection in the outer core induces electric currents and therefore a magnetic field. Some relevant timescales are instructive. In the Earth's core, the magnetic decay time is about 200,000 years. So that's the fundamental decay time for a magnetic structure inside the core. A dipole field, for example, decays on timescale that's least proportional to that. Whereas the convective overturn time is estimated from the time rate of change of the geomagnetic field at the surface, the so-called secular variation, to be about 200 years. So the ratio of these two timescales defines the fundamental dimensionless parameter for the geodynamo and other planetary dynamos, the so-called magnetic Reynolds number, and it's presently estimated to be about 1,000. What we know from a combination of experiments, numerics, and theory is that you need a magnetic Reynolds number of about 40 to produce a self-sustaining dynamo. That's the critical value. So the Earth's core is many times supercritical in that regard. Okay, other timescales. In the mantle, the Wilson cycle. The Wilson cycle is just the timescale for the aggregation of supercontinents and their dispersal. And what we understand from the geologic record, that timescale is of the order of 300 to 400 million years. Whereas the age of the dynamo is, as far as we know, almost as old as the age of the Earth. We have direct evidence that it's at least 3.4 GA, and there's some new evidence that suggests it might be 4 GA. For all we know, it's practically as old as the Earth itself. Okay, so how to make a self-sustaining dynamo? Well, here's my class best illustrative example. These are images from the VKS liquid sodium dynamo experiment, which is currently going on in Cataract in France right now. VKS stands for von Karman sodium. And so basically it has the design of a French washing machine. It's a cylinder of liquid sodium about the size of an oil drum. And there are two impellers positioned, as you can see in the diagram, that rotate in opposite directions. Okay, and they produce intense turbulence between them. And that's depicted in terms of these arrows. The blue arrows denote the primary circulation with the impellers produced by the motion of the impellers. And the red arrows represent the additional motion produced by the fins. Okay? And the combination of these two components of motion means that fluid trajectories, on average, execute helical spirals in this tank. The fluid motion has a property we call helicity, which is just the vector correlation between the fluid velocity and its curl, the fluid vorticity. And it's the presence of a non-zero average helicity, combination of these two flow components, which causes this to act as a dynamo. Here's what it looks like in the lab. And here's an example of the results. Here they're measuring the external magnetic field outside the device as a function of the magnetic Reynolds number defined by the flow velocities. Okay, and what you can see is that there's no amplification of the external field until the magnetic Reynolds number gets to be a little bit larger than 30, and then beyond that, the field amplifies. The two curves correspond to orienting the device parallel to the geomagnetic field and opposite the geomagnetic field to show that you get a bifurcation into the dynamo state in either case. This experiment is interesting for a lot of reasons, and one of them is it produces very nice polarity reversals. So for particular combinations of parameters, in particular very large magnetic Reynolds number towards the end that the device can reach, here's signals of the external magnetic field as a function of time, and the three colors are the three components, X, Y, and Z component, R, theta, and phi, z, phi and r components, cylindrical components of the field. And you can see that they reversed in unison in a regular fashion. So magnetic reversals are a property under certain parameter conditions for this experiment. Well, this is a good way to produce a self-sustaining diamond. I should also say, by the way, this is not completely a fair experiment, because to get dynamo onset and to get these reversals, they have to use a soft ferromagnetic impeller, at least for one of these impellers. If they use a different material for the impellers, like aluminum or stainless steel, they don't get dynamo action. So they're getting a little bit of a boost beyond just purely fluid mechanical induction by the presence of the soft iron, which gives them some additional susceptibility. But beyond that, they aside from that, it produces very interesting results. Now, of course, this is not what we envision flow in the core to look like. We don't have a French washing machine there. We don't have impellers, as far as we know. So we should look a little bit more deeply as into the character of the circulation inside the Earth's core that we can expect. And there's been a lot of work done on the structure of convection under the strong influence of rotation in the spherical geometry of the Earth's core. And I'm an experimentalist, so I've been involved over the years in these kinds of experiments. So basically, these are centrifuges. They're spherical shells that are rotated about a vertical axis, in this case, fast enough so that the effect of gravity is a combination of a strong centrifugal effect plus lab gravity. Okay. And you can choose the rotation rate such that the vector combination of those two effects approximates the gravity field of a self-gravitating sphere, at least in the southern hemisphere of the device. That is to say, gravity is perpendicular to the boundaries. But of course, gravity points in the wrong direction in this experiment compared to the Earth. It points outward rather than inward. So what you need to do is reverse the temperature gradient in the experiment compared to the Earth, and you preserve the orientation of the buoyancy force. So that's the trick in these experiments. And when you do them, here's what you get. Here's some meridional views. Here's the outside of the sphere. Here's the equator of the sphere. Here's a cross section showing the inner core and the rotation axis. And here's an equatorial view. And the amazing thing that you see is that the convection is two-dimensional, or quasi-two-dimensional. It's coherent in the direction of the rotation axis. It's like the fluid has become rigid in the direction of the rotation axis, and it's behaving like a turbulent fluid, if you can see this image, only in the equatorial plane, or in planes parallel to the equator. So it's essentially quasi-two-dimensional fluid motion made regular in the rotation axis direction and behaving like a real fluid in the planes perpendicular to that. So this is due to a constraint that's familiar in rotating fluid mechanics called the Taylor-Poulidman constraint. And the Taylor-Poulidman constraint we expect to be extremely strong inside the Earth's core, so that the fluid motions there should have a predominant cylindrical symmetry or columnar structure to them. Just how that works as a dynamo is illustrated here. So this shows several such columnar vortices, and I've drawn the circulation arrow directions implied by them. So this is a vortex which has positive vorticity, and here's the one next to it which has negative vorticity. And if you assume that the core is such a good conductor that the field lines are essentially frozen in the fluid and get stretched and transported by the fluid motion, then you can map how a magnetic field line will be distorted by this flow. And what it does is, for example, a dipole field would enter the core, and it would be twisted around this vortex. And then because there's a secondary flow which transports fluid from one vortex to the next, the field line will eventually be carried over to the next vortex. But in doing so, it'll be stretched in the direction indicated like this. So this type of field, a dipole field, we call a poloidal magnetic field because it has a radial component. This component of field, it has no radial component, it's called a toroidal field. And what the induction does is it transfers energy from the poloidal field to the toroidal field, and then further convection transfers energy from the toroidal field to a new induced poloidal field. And the object of the game is to get this induced poloidal field to amplify the original one. That's the feedback mechanism that you need to create a self-sustaining dynamo. And by virtue of the helical character of this columnar convection, it is very efficient at doing this. Okay, so if we look at the magnetic field, of course, in the Earth, if we looked at it from space, we would see mostly the interaction with the solar wind. I mean, the Earth's field viewed from space is largely a dipole field. It's inclined right now by about 9.8 degrees with respect to the rotation axis. That's a variable in time, but it's heavily distorted by its interaction with the solar wind, swept downstream away from the sun. If we go to not the surface of the Earth, but to the boundary of the dynamo region, the boundary between the silicate mantle and the metallic core, this is what the magnetic field looks like. You can still recognize a basic dipolar structure. Sorry for the white out here, some of the colors aren't showing, but what you can see is that it's blue in the northern hemisphere and red in the southern hemisphere, meaning field lines enter the core in the northern hemisphere and they exit from the core in the southern hemisphere, basically a dipole structure, but with some important deviations. And some of the most important deviations are examples of what we infer as this columnar symmetry. You see these are two very intense spots of magnetic field are aligned along the same longitude, more or less, as if the field structure inside the core had a cylindrical columnar structure to it. This is a movie, by the way, which I think I can show, showing the evolution of the field over several centuries of time. It turns out since the geomagnetic field was so vital as a means of navigation during the age of exploration, we have very good data on the global structure of the magnetic field going back centuries in time. And so we can actually map how it's evolved on the horizontal boundary over several centuries. And the motion that you saw there then is essentially the motion of the fluid carrying magnetic field lines forward and backward over time. Okay, so how do we represent this phenomena theoretically? So we do it with classical physics. It's a combination of classical fluid mechanics and classical electromagnetism. There is nothing in the current dynamo theory, perhaps Professor Stanley can correct me on this, I think there's nothing in the current dynamo theory that wasn't known in physics by 1890. Is that correct? What wasn't known was how to put the elements together properly. So what are the elements? Navier-Stokes equation, that goes way back, okay? Equation of motion, conservation of momentum for a fluid. The only addition, so this is in scaled form. These are inertial terms, viscous terms. There's a Coriolis acceleration, a pressure force, a buoyancy force. And this new one here is the Lorentz force. So that is the force on a fluid provided by the interaction between electrical currents and magnetic fields in the fluid. And it's what couples fluid motion to the magnetic induction process. To that, you add the induction equation, which is just a combination of the individual equations and Maxwell's equations. Nothing new there, and continuity. And then we're transporting buoyancy, so we have to transport buoyancy. And the common way that's done in models is to define a codensity function, which is a linear combination of temperature and compositional variations inside the core. And there's a transport equation for that. So all these equations here, all of these individual bits of the theory are more than 130 years old, but they weren't successfully put together to produce a self-sustaining dynamo until the last 25 years. A self-sustaining dynamo then represents a solution to these equations in which you produce finite magnetic energy for all time without the additional boost of any external sources. So since those equations were written in non-dimensional form, there's lots of dimensionless parameters, and we can judge how well any model, experimental or laboratory, fits the planetary situation by comparing dimensionless numbers. So in this game, there's lots of dimensionless numbers, and these are just a few of my favorites, okay? But I'm putting them up here to illustrate some of the difficulties and the challenges in representing this phenomena theoretically. So here are the control parameters, the inputs to the experiment or the model. You have to control the rotation. You have to control the convective forcing. You have to control the effects of diffusion. And that leads to four dimensionless parameters, the Ekman number, Rayleigh number, Prandtl number, and magnetic Prandtl number. Here are nominal values that they take inside the Earth's core. Here are nominal values that they have in laboratory and numerical experiments, respectively. And what I want you to get out of this table is the lack of agreement. Okay? In most of the critical parameters, numerical models and lab experiments are orders of magnitude away from reality. However, okay, when you produce a dynamo numerically or in the lab, the results are much better. So here are a summary of some of the outputs. The magnetic Reynolds number, which measures how much fluid velocity you have. The Elsasser number measures the magnetic energy density that you produce in the dynamo. And the local Rossby number is a measure that's parameter is familiar from atmospheres and oceans. It measures turbulence. Okay. So if you look at this part of the table here, the results are actually not bad. We can the magnetic Reynolds number in the core is estimated to the order of 1,000. And numerical simulations, you can get into that regime, and also fairly close in the lab. Same with the Elsasser number. And even this measure of the turbulence, the local Rossby number. Okay, so the results are actually fairly good, despite the fact that the ingredients are individually rather questionable. Okay, so how can that be? It must be that actually the behavior of the dynamo depends on certain combinations, products of these factors here, in which we do have some similarity between an experiment and the real planet. Just what that similarity, what those similarity parameters are, is still a subject of investigation. Nonetheless, I'll show you the kinds of things that is possible, for example, to simulate in a numerical simulation. It's pretty easy to produce what are realistic looking polarity reversals. So here's an example of magnetic field lines in steps. These steps are spaced about 2,000 years apart, showing the sequence of events that result in a magnetic polarity reversal. So the red field lines, the hot colors, correspond to field lines that contribute in a net way to a positive axial dipole moment. The blue field lines are ones that contribute to a negative net axial dipole moment. So it's a simple way to just display one polarity versus another. So in the first sequence of events, what you see is the field starts out with a dominantly red polarity, let's call it, except in this little region right here, okay, where the field happens to be locally reversed. And then this reversal area, area of reversed field, metastasizes. It happens to be located in a region of the core in the simulation where the convection is particularly vigorous. So it gets amplified at the expense of the old polarity field. And you can see that amplification process continuing. You can see the field lines being wound around the columnar vortices and being amplified by that mechanism until you get to the point where the two polarities are about equally matched. Okay? That gives you a structure to the external field we call the transition field, meaning that the net dipole moment of the field in this configuration is practically zero. There is an external field, but there's practically no net dipole to it. And then what happens after this stage appears to be largely a matter of chance. The dynamo favors a strong axial dipole, so that's eventually going to emerge from this. But which polarity emerges is just a matter of just random chance. In this particular simulation here, what reemerged is the new polarity. But sometimes after this stage, it goes back to the old polarity. We call this sequence a reversal, and if it goes back to the old polarity, it's called an excursion. Okay, so it's possible to simulate polarity reversals in the lab. It's possible to simulate them on the computer. Okay, but why do we care? Okay, what's their significance? So why do geomagnetic polarity reversals matter? Well, first of all, it's chronology. The geomagnetic polarity timescale, which I'll talk about in a little bit, is to me one of the biggest accomplishments in Earth science in the 20th century. And we use it as a basic chronology tool. There are also supposedly significant environmental perturbations connected with reversals, because during this phase when the field has this transitional configuration, the dipole is so weak that the external field is correspondingly weak, and the influences of the external field from the sun and the solar wind become amplified in the Earth's environment. So there's some things we can point to, magnetospheric contraction during reversals, that ostensibly leads to increased charged particle flux into the Earth system. The low field intensity is known to affect carbon-14 production, beryllium-10 abundances, and such things. They're interesting just from the fact that they represent the extreme forms of variability of the geomagnetic field. There's lots of variability in the geomagnetic field, but reversals and excursions certainly qualify as the extreme members of that set. But the one that interests me and the one I want to speak on a little bit in detail here is the geodynamic connection. So the idea is that the reversals, their probability or their frequency, depends on the rate at which energy is being extracted from the core. And that process is inevitably controlled by what surrounds the core, that is the mantle. So that if we look at and can understand what controls the rate at which geomagnetic reversals occur and relate that to the rate at which they're observed, we can say something about how the core and the mantle interact. So I have a slide that just puts this into sort of a giant perspective. This is a bit busy. The top part of the slide shows effects inside the core. The lower part, or the middle part here, shows effects inside the mantle. So let's go back 550 million years. This is the geomagnetic polarity time scale. It includes, so N represents normal polarity, R represents reverse polarity, and the density of the lines in this plot give you some idea of the frequency with which reversals have occurred over the last 550 million years, the Phanerozoic time. Okay? There are about 970 known reversals during this time, so the average rate is about 2 per million years. Right now, the rate of reversals is significantly higher than that. It's near 4 per million years over the last few million years. But it's quite variable. In particular, there are three known times in the Phanerozoic, one in the Cretaceous, one in the Permian, and one back in the Ordovician, when the field either didn't reverse for a very long time or reversed so infrequently that it was practically fixed. Okay? These are called magnetic superchrons. This one lasted about 40 million years, this about 30. This one's less well resolved. Perhaps it lasted 20 million years. Okay? This variation in the duration of chrons is very far from random. If you look at the variation in a very short time interval, you can show that it follows more or less Poisson statistics, as if the timing of reversals are random. Okay. But the odds of getting a superchron of 40 million years out of a random process in which the average reversal rate is 2 per million years is approximately the same as flipping 80 heads in a row. And the geomagnetic field has done that three times in the last 600 million years. Okay. So that is not a stationary random process. That is a process in which the dynamo has evolved or moved from one configuration to another. That's the dynamo. What about the mantle that overlies it? What are the major events in mantle history, if you like, over this period of time? Well, the major event in mantle history is the Wilson cycle. That is to say, the aggregation of the supercontinent Pangaea and its subsequent dispersal into the configuration of continents that we see on the globe today. So these panels here show the positions of continents over this period of time, the assembly of Pangaea up to about 330 million years ago, and then the existence of the supercontinent Pangaea and its subsequent breakup starting about 200 million years ago, where it has evolved into the present configuration. So this is what the Earth's surface was doing, and presumably the mantle was responding to that. What was happening deeper inside the Earth? Well, you remember ago I mentioned that the heat flow out of the core is somewhere between 10 and 16 terawatts estimated. If you use those numbers and ask how fast does the inner core solidify given that heat loss from the core as a whole, and then calculate the growth of the inner core on that basis, you see that the inner core has evolved from this size to about to its present size over this period of time. So all major parts of the Earth system are evolving during this. And the question is there any relationship, causal relationship between these? And that's what I've been interested in exploring over the last few years. So here's my idea about that. What controls geomagnetic reversals? What we know from numerical simulations is that the effect of convection, represented by an increase in the Rayleigh number, drives the dynamo from a state of, well, for weak convection, there's no dynamo, but it starts off in a dipolar non-reversing state, and it evolves with increasing Rayleigh number to a multipolar dynamo, which hyper-reversals. In between, there's a transition region, and the effect of rotation is opposite that. So rotation works in this direction, convection works in this direction. And these contours represent contours of this turbulence parameter, the local Rossby number, which I mentioned before. So imagine we start with the Earth sometime in its history in this position. It's in the transition region where it reverses every once in a while. And we ask, how did the core evolve in this diagram over geologic time? Tidal friction tells us that the rotation rate of the Earth has decreased secularly with time. At the same way, the Earth's core has cooled, so it's the intensity of the convection has evolved in response to its thermal history. So I'm going to talk about just what's called regular or monotonic evolution, which is a combination of secular cooling and tidal friction. And basically, the calculations indicate that the core would evolve along a trajectory like this. That is to say, sub-parallel, or maybe even parallel to these contours, which define the frequency of reversals. So what you get out of this is basically dynamical similarity. In other words, all the individual factors that control the state of the core are changing. The convection is changing with time. The rotation rate is changing with time. The inner core is growing, but the dynamics of the core remain invariant. Okay. That's if the core cools monotonically, but what if it cooled irregularly? What if there were periods of time when the core cooled rapidly, but other periods of time where it cooled more slowly because of the influence of the variability in the mantle, which dictates the rate at which the core cools? Then if it started off at the same position, now consider variable evolution, it might execute a trajectory like this to this position. And what would that produce? That would produce reversal cycling. During this part of the phase, the reversals would be infrequent or non-existent, like supercrons. And during this part of the cycle, they would be more frequent. So that's just an idea, okay? Can we test that? Well, one way to test that is to take a state-of-the-art model of the evolution of the mantle and subject it to a model of the geodynamo, and see how evolution of the mantle actually does affect the evolution of the dynamo, at least in terms of that interaction. So what we've done here is create a whole Earth dynamo. It's driven by core mantle boundary heat flow that comes from a model of mantle history, which is constrained by the observed plate motions of the mantle. And what we're going to do is calculate the thermal evolution of the core that includes inner core growth, chemical differentiation, tidal friction, increase in the length of the day. Whoop. Yes, back to where we were. That's going to give us time-dependent dynamo control parameters and boundary conditions. And then we're going to tune the dynamo model to present-day reversal rates. So this is the kind of technique that's used in climate modeling the paleoclimate. You tune the model to the present day, and you see what kind of predictions it makes in the past. And we're going to compare the dynamo reversals with observed reversals from the GPTS in the past. Okay, so this is the most complicated slide. This shows you the mantle history model that we've used in this reconstruction. Okay, so this is the present-day Earth. This is 110 million years ago. Here's the mantle 200 million years ago and 350 million years ago. And what's plotted in this panel here is the surface heat flow connected to plate clearly related to plate boundaries. This is the seafloor age. These are continents in the past. And the most important column is this one over here, which shows the variation in heat flow at the core mantle boundary, which we're using to drive the dynamo model. The most important transformations in, or evolution in this, is a change in structure of the lower mantle from one dominated by a single region where the heat flow is high underneath Pangaea, L equals 1 at 350 million years ago, to the current day structure, which has two regions of high heat flow that form a nearly complete great circle around the Earth, spherical harmonic degree L equals 2. So it's this major transformation, which is the dominant structural change, and also the mean heat flow changes with time, being low during this time compared to the present day. If we put this in terms of the effect on the time-dependent dynamo control parameters, the Ekman number and the Rayleigh number relative to their present-day values, we start off with 1-1 at the present-day Earth, and we move backward in time. And the red dots show the effect of regular evolution of the core. This is the trajectory backward in time that these control parameters would take as if the core cooled in a monotonic fashion, the red dots. Our whole Earth dynamo, which is influenced by the dynamics of the mantle, it executes a slightly different trajectory. It lies above the monotonic curve during recent times, but then it falls below it significantly down around the time when Pangaea was assembled. So this, the deviation between the blue curve and the red curve is the effect of the Wilson cycle on the geodynamo. And what we want to see is this effect large enough to cause a variation in the reversal rate comparable to what we see in the geomagnetic polarity timescale? So to do that, we first have to tune our dynamo model. So we adjust the other parameters that we have control over to produce, in present day, the observed reversal rate. So this is, these are plots of the dipole moment as a function of time. This is over a little bit more than like 5 million years. And here's our whole Earth dynamo model with an average reversal rate of 3.8 per million years. The two polarities are shown as shaded and unshaded, respectively. What you can see is how the dipole field collapses during into a transition configuration at the boundary of each of these polarity crons. Each of these polarity crons is marked by a dipole collapse. And to compare this with data, this is the observed GPTS over the last 5 million years. And although the timing of the reversals isn't the same, the duration of the crons is quite comparable. And this is a record of the intensity of the magnetic field inferred from the magnetization of seafloor sediments, the SINT 2000 record. And what you can see is the same association in this data between dipole collapse events and the cron boundaries. And the general character of this signal is more or less comparable to the character of our model. The model values, of course, have been scaled up to Earth-like conditions. And not only does this slide isn't going to look very good, we won't bother with that one. Okay, so let's just go back in the past. So we've tuned the dynamo to the present day, and now we're going to take it back in the past along the evolutionary curve I showed you earlier and ask, can we match past reversal times? Okay, so here's at 50 million years, 100 million years, 180, 275, 330, and 425. Okay, at 50 million years, this is the whole Earth dynamo, and here's the GPTS over the same period of time. And you can see that at 50 million years, we're getting a few more reversals than what is observed, but the numbers aren't radically different. However, at 100 million years, the geodynamo was in the Cretaceous supercron, and our dynamo model reverses, if anything, more frequently than it's doing today. So this is a clear misfit. And the reason for it is that reconstructions of the mantle indicate that plate speeds were very high during the middle of the Cretaceous. And that energized the whole mantle, increases the heat flow out of the mantle, into the mantle from the core, and causes these rapid reversals, whereas what's observed is a supercron. So that's a misfit. But things get better. At 180 million years, we're back on track. The reversal rate is about right. And lo and behold, this is the one success we have. At 275 million years, we get what amounts to an incipient supercron. We get plenty of dipole collapses, but none of them produce reversals at the time of the Keumann reverse supercron. This event, as I indicated earlier, is, I think, an expression of the Wilson cycle. It was the time when Pangaea had assembled and the flow in the mantle was reconfiguring from this dominant spherical harmonic L equals 1 form to the form it has the present day. The mantle was quiet then, and that is what produces the supercron conditions in our model. We go back further in time, 330 million years, we get some agreement, some misfit, and then back 475, we also get a supercron, but for reasons that I'm not exactly clear about. So we're able to simulate a portion of the magnetic history of the Earth, at least the portion that we can more closely tie to the large-scale dynamics of the mantle through the Wilson cycle. Still with some work to do. Okay, so very last, where's the frontier? Okay. Well, there's a planned frontier, an unplanned frontier. This subject's full of serendipity. Things that are planned, there's an effort now to build more advanced numerical dynamos, ones that are more realistic. There are satellites that are imaging the geomagnetic field now and missions planned for other planets, like the Juno mission to Jupiter, spacecraft missions. But there's a huge component of serendipity in this subject, and I just want to mention two items. One is discoveries that have been made in the last 10 years about the surprising structure at the very center of the Earth, in the inner core, and what the dynamical implications of that structure is. And then something, another subject, if I have time, geomagnetic jerks. Okay, so what about the inner core? So this is a cross-section of the Earth showing the surface, the core mantle boundary, and the inner core boundary. This is the inner core right here. And the inner core, especially its outer portions, are very well sampled by seismic waves. And in particular, you can make detailed comparison between waves that just penetrate into the inner core a little bit versus waves which stay in the outer core. And differences in travel times as a function of angular distance and azimuth give us a picture of what the internal structure of the inner core is. And what's been revealed by this over the last 20 years is that the inner core has a surprising amount of structure. In particular, it has a large-scale variation in its anisotropy. The inner core is solid and anisotropic, but one hemisphere of the inner core, the western hemisphere, has much more anisotropy than the eastern. This display here shows this is the inner core boundary, and the length of the little rods in this diagram indicate the amount of anisotropy, and the orientation of the rod indicates the primary direction of that anisotropy. And you can see that there's this general hemispherical difference. Okay. In addition to that, seismologists have discovered a layer above the inner core where the seismic velocities differ substantially from what they are in the rest of the outer core in a way that indicates that this layer has an increased density relative to the outer core as a whole. So there's a host of interpretations that have been given to this anisotropy. What's remarkable about it, this is a structure which is right at the center of the Earth, at the bottom of the Earth's gravitational well. And it was, in some respects, the last place people would expect to see a lot of deviation from a radial symmetry. But there it is. And I just want to mention the most provocative interpretation of what this means. The most provocative interpretation in my mind is that this structure is an indication that the inner core is unstable in its present position at the center of the Earth and is undergoing what's called a translational instability. So a translational instability is something like a glacier, the action of a glacier, in which the inner core moves in the equatorial plane laterally from one side to the other, east or west. This diagram here depicts translation to the west. And what would happen then, because this is a phase boundary, is that on the upstream side, on the leading edge or forward edge, the inner core would melt, and that on the trailing edge, it would solidify particularly fast. The solidification releases light elements and produces intense convection, and the melting produces this dense fluid enriched in iron, producing this anomalous layer, which is called the F layer. Okay. If this mechanism is true, then the grayscale contours which are shown there actually represent age contours of the material in the inner core. So that is young, recently solidified at this edge, and older, having solidified earlier at this edge. Okay, that's the inner core translation anisotropy. And one more thing, just for serendipity. Okay. All right, so there's an enormous effort to inventory exoplanets throughout the cosmos. And the time will come soon when some exoplanet is determined to be magnetized, perhaps along the lines of the processes which we envision for the Earth's core and also planets within our solar system. Okay. But how exactly that comes about, whether it comes about through a dedicated observation program or by serendipity, remains to be seen. And my example of the role of serendipity in this endeavor is this one right here. So you know that the largest known planetary dynamo in the cosmos, Jupiter's magnetic field, was not discovered on the basis of a spacecraft mission. It was discovered actually on a farm. This one right here, about 20 miles from where I live, in 1955, two scientists from the Carnegie Institute of Washington had strung together a very rudimentary radio telescope, which consisted of really of nothing more than telephone poles supporting a string of copper wire. And the first time they connected the circuits together and began to calibrate the device, at least according to story, they picked up a periodic signal, which had the same period as Jupiter's rotation. And they recognized this as a cyclotron emission coming out from a magnetic field at Jupiter. And it was the discovery of the largest planetary dynamo. So that's an accident that would be very, very difficult to predict. And I would imagine that there are equally large number of surprises waiting us and perhaps people in the audience in this subject in the future. So thank you for listening.